everyone, and welcome back to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. Today I get to talk with label mate from F-Spot Records, Michael Duffy, about his group The White Blinds and their 45, Brown Bag, Muddy Water, which is out right now. Super excited to talk with them. Great, great organ trio, great soul jazz. Please help me welcome Michael.
Yeah, what's going on, man?
How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. So are you located on the West Coast as well?
Yeah, born and raised Angeleno.
That's good. I mean, I am myself a transplant and I meet mostly transplants, but every now and then we come across a native Angeleno and they're good people, I think.
Yeah, I mean, my parents came from other places. You know, my dad came from Ireland and my mom came from Oklahoma. So, you know, I'm the first one born here in California.
Excellent. Well, hopefully not the last. That clan will be going strong.
Oh, no, it's been going strong for a bit.
Well, that's always good. Yeah, so it'll be really informal today. Thank you for coming on Deeper Grooves podcast. As you know, we love F-Spot and David Cilia, and so we're super happy that he connected us with you. We were quite familiar with the White Blinds. We had seen you guys kind of play out and about and heard your full-length release that came out in the last year or so. But we wanted to chat, first starting off, about your latest single. So you guys have a 45 out right now featuring Brown Bag and Muddy Water. And so I wanted to understand kind of how those sessions came in to create that 45.
So when we finished Get to Steppin', the band was sounding really good. I had talked with David, the owner of F-Spot, about doing an homage series where the A-side would be an homage to either an organ trio or a soul jazz artist, and then doing an original on the B-side. So we started with the single Simple Song, Sly, and then the Charles Erlin version kind of mixed together. And then we did, keeping it kind of in the Oakland thing, the original on the B-side is called Clapback, and it was a beat I lifted from my favorite drummer, or one of my favorite drummers, Mike Clark. And my imagination was, what would it be like if Mike Clark and Chester Thompson got together and made an organ trio track? And then I always loved this guitar part from Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, Michael Jackson. And so we kind of just twisted those three things together to make that B-side. And then getting to the one we have currently with Muddy Water and Brown Bag, my favorite soul jazz guitarist or organ trio guitarist is Ivan Boogaloo Joe Jones. And he had that great track and I always loved it. But I always felt if I was going to cover it or we were going to cover it, I wanted to kind of add something to it. So we added a B section. What I did is I sat with our guitarist, Matt Hornbeck. We kind of chopped up a bunch of Ivan's guitar solos. And through those guitar solos, we made a B section to that tune to kind of just add to it. And I feel like if you're going to cover something, it's nice to kind of put your own fingerprint on it. And then on the B side, we did this tune called Muddy Water. And it's basically, I love the Rolling Stones, as we all do in the band. And so it was just kind of like, what would the Rolling Stones sound like if they were an organ trio? So that's how we came to that.
That's definitely an interesting approach. And I'm super excited you mentioned Mike Clark. I'm a huge fan. And we've had him on the podcast. And he is amazing and talking about Actual Proof and stuff like that. But it's nice that you're able to put your own stamp on it. I think, you know, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, that's an amazing guitar lick. And I'm glad that someone is doing something else with it, interpolating it in a different way. So then you are kind of like the flagship artist for F-Spot Records. And so how did you initially kind of forge that relationship and come to meet David and join the label or create that?
It's a funny story. So if anyone knows anything about me, the band that I did prior to, I've been a freelance most of my life, freelancer for almost 30 years. But about 10 years ago, I did my first original project that I actually really put time into. And that was a band called Jungle Fire. And through that, I forged a relationship with Coal Mine Records. So when I got the courage and the confidence to spread my wings a little bit and start the White Blinds, I approached Terry Cole. And I think at that same time, he was already courting Delvon Lamar. And so, you know, I sent him some demos and it was met with just kind of a mixed response. I wasn't really sure if he was interested. So at that time, while I was playing with Jungle Fire, I was working with a young guitarist by the name of Lito Mangana. And Lito was like, hey, man, I just did a record with this guy, David Celia, and he's got a new label called F-Spot Records. You guys should meet. So he set up the meet, and I sat with David, and David was just like, I'm all in. I'm all in. I want to do it. And just his kind of demeanor and his support at that time with getting something, you know, new off the ground, I just felt good in my gut. And so he was just incredibly supportive. He didn't really grind us much. And funny thing is, he didn't even hear any of the demos before we went in the studio. We just literally went in the studio together and made Get the Step In. And he kind of heard everything as it was coming out of the band. Yeah, it was an amazing experience. And obviously, it's forged an amazing relationship between he and I to now that not only do we share the success of the White Flines, but we share a band together in the Bombillas. So it's been a great relationship.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's interesting, too. I feel like all of us in the funk trade kind of bump heads with the same people. So, I mean, we've worked with Lito and Mestizo Beat and you know, Sergio and Orgone and talked with Terry and Colmine many, many times. And so I think everyone that's kind of like-minded ends up making that world very, very small. But I do understand what you're saying about my work with David and just understanding how he really kind of gets out of the way and lets the artist do what they're going to do. And I think that's great. That's very old school approach in a lot of ways. But at the end of the day, I think people create the best art when they have less limitations. I mean, you look at someone like a Prince, for example. It's like, you know, his first album, For You, he did everything himself. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people actually listened to it until a few albums in. But if Warner Brothers and the A&R at the time didn't allow him to be able to work through the process, and then eventually people, you know, when your second or third album kind of hits or whatever you do, go back to your old stuff, then they kind of get, you know, what you were thinking about at the time and your vision. But a lot of times now, with the record industry in some places, either it has to fit a certain thing or sound like someone, or, you know, you really kind of have the one shot. And then if it doesn't take off, then they kind of feel a certain way. But I think that's cool. I think that's cool that he didn't hear anything until actually it was coming out, because I think maybe you guys didn't know exactly what was going to come out either until you're on the other side of it. And I think that's kind of the natural, organic process. But that makes sense that you came from other groups. I did see that you had done stuff with Jungle Fire and with Ozzy Motley, and your organist Kerry Frank also worked with Tedeschi Trucks. So, like, what was it like playing with those types of bands?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, again, I've been a freelancer for 30 years, so I've had a chance to play with a lot of really great people. My time with Ozzy Motley was about, I want to say, a little, maybe under 2 years. And I traveled the world with those guys, and it was a great experience. And it was a great experience for me to be in a situation where the lineage of drummers that had passed through that chair were incredible and very different. And having to cop their grooves or their feel, I'd never really had that experience. I was, you know, up until that point, I was able to kind of just be me. So it was the first time I had to really put someone else's shoes on and go for a walk, per se. And that was, it was a tough go for, I would probably say, about the first month, but then I got better at it. I'm still not the greatest at it. I'm, you know, I can copy to a point, but eventually the duff comes out, as they say. Yeah, my time with those guys was great. And then from there, with a lot of other great bands around LA and subbing in until, you know, I about 10 years ago, I was pretty much done with being a sideman. And I think my meeting with Joey Reyna, Sam Halterman, Judd McDaniel of the band Simple Citizens and the Rugged Nuggets and the beginnings of what would become Jungle Fire really kind of changed my path to take off the sideman shoes and put on the big boy boots and do my own thing.
That's great. That's great. And I can definitely see how that can be difficult, stepping into filling someone's shoes and parts that they've played. And I've been in that situation. And that's definitely a skill in its own. So I could see how then from that, the natural extension would be to be able to break out and do your own thing, which you're able to do with your group. So how did you actually kind of Wizard of Oz style find the players for the trio? How did your Tin Man and your Scarecrow, however you want to call them, how did you add in the other parts to be able to become the White Blinds?
Well, I think the genesis of the White Blinds was the fact that there were some organ players in town, and there was another group that I was friends with, a group called the Rump Roller Organ Trio. The guitarist, James Aker, and I had played previously together around town and we're in a band together. And he said, come check it out. And then I met drummer Kevin Stevens. We realized we had a lot in common. So they were kind of getting it going. Simultaneously, I was doing Jungle Fire and really kind of focused on that. And I remember James and I had lunch one day and he said, man, we just lost our organ trio to Katy Perry. Our organist, not our organ trio, our organist, like, Katy Perry. That would be a weird one. But do you know any organists? And at that time, I was asking around and someone said, hey, there's this young kid who studied with Dr. Lonnie Smith. His name is Kerry Frank. I said, give me his number. And I never even spoke to Kerry. I just kind of passed the information to my buddy James. And Kerry started playing with the Rump Roller. They had a steady, it was a steady Monday night at Sassafras. And I used to pop in and just kind of check on things. And I popped in the beginning and Kerry sounded great. He was fantastic, but you could tell he hadn't probably played an organ in a while. He was mostly probably studying jazz piano at the time. And I just kept kind of popping in. And at that point, they were playing a lot more, less jazz stuff and more like meters, funky stuff. And I popped in one night and they played, I think it was Funky Miracles, what they were playing. And I sat down and I just looked at his feet and I said, oh, okay, it's time. I called him up. I think I'd got off the road. I was playing with a guy named Donovan Frankenreiter. It was my last touring gig. And I got off the road, ended my time with Donovan. And I called up Kerry, and I think it was probably like the end of the year in 2015. And I just said, hey, I've curated a list of covers. And I'd like to know if you'd like to start a more funky soul jazz side of organ trio, not so jazzy. And he was game. He was super game. And he was young, you know, at the time, and I just hungry to get out and play. And then at the onset of the band, I used Patrick Bailey from Jungle Fire on guitar. And we went through a couple guitarists till we found Matt Hornbeck. And I found Matt Hornbeck because of we both attended the University of North Texas. So through my North Texas network, someone said, oh, you should hit up Matt. And once I played with Matt one time, I knew he was the dude. I knew it from the onset. He just had the right energy and how we all three clicked together. And probably about 2 or 3 months after that, we wrote Get to Steppin' and then went in the studio and did it.
Interesting. Well, I could definitely see adding someone from your school would be great. They have a lot of great players that have gone through there in North Texas. I believe North Jones at one time went there and a bunch of other people, but yeah, excellent. Excellent to be able to figure out how organically you kind of all come together. Organ is all about the feet, as I know from gospel music and other stuff. So I could see how that would make Kerry ready to go. And that's cool. It's nice to be able to see the trajectory of creating the full-length LP and then into these 45s. I think there's so much growth and potential for you guys. Now, when we talk about the White Blinds as far as influences, I saw that Flea Market Funk wrote about you guys and he said, you know, he put you in the same vein in the modern day as Delvin Lamar, who you mentioned, Organ Trio, and Chris Hazleton, Boogaloo 7. But there's also a ton of early organ trios like Bill Doggett and Hank Marr and Dave Baby Cortez, Jimmy McGriff, and the bossiest organ of them all, Jimmy Smith, and Dr. Lonnie Smith, of course. And so, you know, Variety Magazine said that Jimmy Smith, after him, you know, he single-handedly reinvented the Hammond B3 and organ jazz in the model for the organ jazz trio. So who do you guys consider like your go-tos for inspiration and, you know, your template for how you were trying to formalize the White Blind?
Well, I would definitely say, you know, Jimmy is, you can't ever say organ trio without saying him, just because of his sheer depth as an organ player. But I would probably say Lonnie is my personal guru, so much so we wrote a tune for him on Get to Steppin'. And I would say that my love for Lonnie comes from being able to see Lonnie play and experience his magic. But when it comes to the direct influence for the White Blinds, it doesn't really come from the past. It comes from something more like in the mid-90s to the early 2000s, when I discovered Organ Trio as a college student. And I discovered Organ Trio through a band called the City Champs. And the City Champs is a really great organ trio out of Memphis, Tennessee. And they just really blew me away, because as you listen to the shape of soul jazz and organ trios and all that stuff, we all know that organ trios come out of the burlesque kind of stripper era of things, and needing a powerful thing to happen in a club, but don't have a lot of money. And it evolved from that into, getting out into the world and taking pop music and putting into the jazz world. And I came to all that later, but through the City Champs and Soul Live, those were the first two things I heard, an organ trio, and went, whoa, what's this? And through them, discovered Grant Green and all the great, classic organ groups. But the City Champs were the main influence for the White Blinds, because they wrote tunes. They didn't really write, kind of jazz 6 minute to 8 minute opuses. They wrote, tunes, 3 minute tunes. And to me, that was something I wanted to foster and see if I could add to that. Taking solos and all that stuff, I think it's really cool for a certain amount of your audience. But I would say the bulk of the audience that seem to be drawn to the White Blinds are drawn to the fact that it's, their songs and their melodies that they can really attach themselves to. So I would say that, we take a balance of things. We take a balance from the past, from the guys coming from the jazz world, and taking jazz and soul music and combining that together with some of the stuff that happened in the early 90s and even the early 2000s with organ groups, kind of reviving the soul jazz thing. And even great bands like Grey Boy All-Stars, who was a big influence on me as well. The idea of taking that classic material and then maybe, more cutting it down into a song format. And that's kind of where we landed at.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, I could definitely, I don't even necessarily think of that resurgence of the 90s, but that would make sense. And that resurgence is based on what came before. So it seems like a hodgepodge of all coming together, but it makes sense. We kind of, our minds are melded musically around when we're coming up and what we're gravitating to at that time when we're young and getting into it. So then how did you originally get into drumming? Being from LA, like, how did you gravitate to drums? How did you figure out that you had an affinity to play music?
I was in junior high, and I was really fucking up really bad in life and doing bad things and driving my parents absolutely nuts. I think to the point where my mom was about ready to send me off to a military academy because I was just being a bad kid. And she was in the principal's office, and I was going into high school the next year, and the band director from the high school was kind of overhearing my mom and her kind of frustration with me. And I think at that point she was almost driven to tears, which is my badness. And he said, you know what, send your son to me. And my mom was actually a very artistic person. My dad, not so much, but my mom's a painter. She played guitar. She was a fantastic dancer. And so I had a sense of rhythm about me. I always had since I was a kid. But I didn't know I could be a drummer until I met this gentleman. And his name was Perry Hall. So when I went to high school in the ninth grade, I just kind of showed up. And he was not only the band director of the high school I went to in Riverside, California, but he was an amazing drummer. And he kind of had this track history for taking broken kids and forming them into great drummers. And he really took an interest in me and kind of shaped me into a good amount of who I am today. I would say a good 50% of the things that I regurgitate to young people about drumming, I would say, are his words. So, he got me on path, kind of put the right records in my hands and got my hands together and, shipped me off out into the world. And, once I got to North Texas, kind of everything bloomed from there. And it's just been, it's been an incredible journey to this point.
That definitely sounds like an incredible journey. And, wow, to be kind of a wayward person, troublemaker. It's nice that a lot of people, I think, find solace in music, and some kids just need an outlet and something to do. And that was great that your band director at the time, didn't back down from a challenge or saw that need and a way to, you know, channel your energy constructively, because that's important with all children, I think. And so now that you guys have been doing your albums and you have the 45, what do you think will be next musically for you?
So we got one more 45. It's a 3-part series. The next 45 is going to feature a song by Rusty Bryant. It's a tune called Fire Eater, and it has another one of my favorite drummers, Idris Muhammad. So we do that on the A side, and on the B side, we took a tune from a great DJ in town by the name of Miles Tackett. He put out a compilation, and there's this tune called Girls in Miniskirts, and I just love that riff. And so we kind of lifted a little bit of that riff and created our own song called Shimmy Sham. So that comes out. I think David wants to do it sometime in the new year. I don't want to say January or February. I'm not really sure yet, but I know he's mixing it right now and getting it on the docket to get going. So that'll come out next year. And then currently I'm halfway done writing the next record. And we will probably go in the studio, I want to say in the summer, and cut that next record probably for a 22 release. And beyond that, I think we're like everybody else. We're kind of just indoors creating, you know, there isn't really much thought on our end to do a live streaming concert or a socially distanced thing. I think I've come to the point of it where I'm just like, hey, let's create and build the vault and put as much of our creative energy into writing and stacking the vault so that, you know, when things do thin out and we're able to go out and play music again, we can kind of do it and have a lot more bullets in our gun to shoot out in the world.
Nice. Is there anyone that you haven't worked with that you would like to?
Everyone I want to work with is unfortunately not living, or I mean, I'd love to work with Lonnie. I don't even know if Lonnie's playing much right now. I know he had a stroke a year ago. Mm-hmm. And he'd probably be the only one that's alive that I want to work with. But, you know, I've been fortunate enough to play with two organists that are in the scene right now, Adam Scone and Delvon Lamar. Both I was able to go on the road with and tour with. And so that was a dream. If we're speaking of Oregon Trio, I think outside of that, good Lord, that list might be pretty long. But I would say, for the most part, the guys that I really wanted to play with, I've got to play with. So I feel blessed that I've got to do that.
That is a blessing. Not everybody can say that. That's for sure. So then we always have two rapid fire questions that we ask as we start to wrap up to all of our guests. And the first of two is, what advice would you give an up and coming musician starting out?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I think that's a 2-part question. So I think if you really want to get the most juice out of being a musician, don't have a plan B. And I'll cut that with another thing. If like, don't let your insecurities rule your decisions. Those were the two bits of advice I would give.
That's nice advice. And so what do you want your legacy to be when it's all said and done? And it might be too soon to say, but what do you ultimately want to be remembered for most? In life and music?
I think in life that I wasn't an asshole. I was always a good hang on the road. I think when it comes to drumming, that I was always funky, or as funky as I could be. I think when it comes to the thing that's important in my life now, and that's Oregon Trio, is that I added to the lineage, and I hopefully did a good job in adding to that lineage to turn on future generations to soul jazz and the importance that it plays in jazz. Even though it's the bastard child of jazz, I think it really plays an important part in jazz and obviously in Oregon Trio.
Yeah, and for those that are not in the know, could you just briefly explain your concept of what soul jazz is and compare it to the jazz idiom? I mean, there's so many genres of jazz or subgenres of jazz. What is considered soul jazz?
So soul jazz to me, this is my take on it. And obviously I wasn't around in the time, but it's in my research and just kind of absorbing the music. You know, jazz was the pop music of the time. And when the Beatles came and Elvis came and you know, pop music was to change, jazz musicians were trying to figure out how to make a living. And in the process of making a living, it was playing those pop type feels. But, you know, because these guys are swing musicians, they're always going to have a swing to it. So the combination of them interpreting straight eighth music, pop music, and then kind of with their swung eighth kind of thing, you get the soul side of things taking from soul music and pop music, and then obviously the swung eighth thing of jazz. And I think those, that marriage of it together created, I think, one of the funkiest things, you know, because for me as a drummer, and I can speak on this for, because it's my instrument, is what turned me on to soul jazz was hearing guys like Idris and guys that had like more of a jazz, funky, open tuning drum set, but not, you know, feathering the bass drummer or just playing the straight ride beat. They were playing funk beats or New Orleans street beats on these kind of jazz drums. And it has a, for me, an energy that just really overtook me. And anyone who knows, who's worked with me in this white blinds format, when they set up mics in front of the drums or they want to kind of change the drum tuning, I get kind of a little angry. I'm just like, no, that's the sound. You have to make that sound, you know, because of how it affected me as a young man, you know, hearing that sound of those drums in a funky concept. So that's my two cents on soul jazz. But, ultimately, I think it just was jazz musicians trying to figure out how to pay the rent for the next thing as life evolved and the times evolved.
I hear that. And we're still evolving and people are trying to figure out how to pay the rent. So I think it'll continue to have an evolution. Now, for me, as a music nerd, knowing that the drums are a non-melodic instrument, what is the process of you guys writing your music? You said you were working on finishing up writing the stuff. How do you write it and that translate into the melodic instruments from the rhythm and the backbeat of the drums?
So I learned to write music from my brother, from another, Mr. Steve Haney from Jungle Fire. My relationship with him in that band, funny note, we are born the same day, same year, and both play percussion. He was my ride along for, 10 years in that band. And he would sing stuff into his iPhone. He would have these ideas for tunes and he would start singing stuff. And it really, I was like, wait, you're not writing it down? It's like, why the hell should I write it down? These are my ideas coming out of my head. And that really influenced me and gave me a concept and confidence to do it myself that way. So I write in two ways. I sing into my phone or I sample things that I like and I bring them to Carrie and Matt. And I probably drive them crazy because it's just not, they're more like, even though I went to a trained music school, I'm not a composer in the traditional way. So, those guys are coming from that side of things. And so it's been an interesting marriage of them trying to understand the creative concept coming out of me and how we all work together to put that on the paper to get it into the studio and get it done. But I guess I would say my writing is more coming from a hip hop concept of sampling and just kind of speaking my passion to the guys.
That makes sense. That makes sense. A lot of people do that, especially now that you can dictate into your iPhone or Android. A lot of people do sing into their phone. I think the method is called a down dump, where you're just basically dumping your ideas literally from your head out into some kind of tangible medium so you can at least not forget them. And I think that's great. And, also when you talk about composition or not being a traditional composer, I think there's a lot of people that have been very successful and able to do that. You look at, in the pop and writing world, you look at someone like Irving Berlin. Irving Berlin wrote more songs than almost anyone. I think he, in his lifetime, copyrighted 800 songs or so, and his songbook is part of the Great American Songbook. But he could only play his keyboard in one key. He had a certain type of keyboard where it moved levers and it transposed for him, but he could only play in that one key. It wasn't C, it was something with a lot of sharps or flats or something, but don't let anyone tell you there's only one way to be able to write. As long as you can figure it out and translate that to someone and they can, iterate off of your ideas, then I think you're well on your way. So it's always nice for me to be able to, and the listeners to be able to hear kind of the process, because everybody's process, when you talk to Mike Clark or you talk to Stanley Jordan, whoever it is, everyone's process is unique and different to them. And sometimes it only is understood to them, but that's cool. I was very curious to know how you would do that. So that's great. Well, we definitely enjoyed having our time with you today, Michael, and hearing more about the White Blinds. We've been listening to your music digitally. We have the vinyls as well. And so super looking forward to this next vinyl coming out in 2021. I think that's a great approach to, you know, continue to add things into your vault, into your arsenal, and into the music canon. I think you have a captive audience. More people are probably streaming more than ever now. As you get the stuff out, more people are also, you know, collecting vinyl and taking time to sit down and listen to vinyl, which is also a different experience. So that's always good, but super excited and so happy to be able to talk to you and learn more about you. And we'll circle back to you guys and to the label when everything is out for this episode so that we can post it and share it with everyone. But we look forward to hearing more from you and talking to you again in the future.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, man. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Have a good day.
You too. Hey everyone, you just listened to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. I had a blast talking with organ trio drummer Michael Duffy from the White Blinds on F-Spot Records about their latest 45, Brown Bag, Muddy Water. You should definitely go check it out on all streaming platforms, or you can buy the vinyl at www.fspotrecords.com. I'd like to thank our engineer Tim Hall from 1192 Studios for mixing and mastering this recording today. If you like what you hear and you want to hear more, you can check us out online at www.californiasoulmusic.com/deepergrooves or anchor.fm/deepergrooves. Until then, keep it funky, keep it snazzy, keep it jazzy. We'll talk to you soon.